Welcome to the Opium Den interview. I'm Daniel Williams. Today is August 28th. It's a Friday, and it's a beautiful day down here in paradise. A little hot, but the skies are clear. We've had a lot of rain lately. But it's a beautiful day. And a good day to bring back a good friend of the show, someone who we have spoken with before, a young man by the name of Chris Crane. Chris Crane is the former past executive director of SSDP, which is Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And as I mentioned, Chris has been on the show before, and we're glad to get him back inside the Opium Den today. Chris has been enjoying his August, probably more so than our congressional members back home, but Chris has spent is spending the month of August perusing a couple of job opportunities that have been presented, and we're pretty sure here inside the Opium Den, Chris will do very well. He's one of the brightest guys I've met. I've known Chris for a number of years. One of the brightest guys in drug policy reform. And although I wish him well, I hope his future is not very long, because that would mean we've made some progress in repealing drug prohibition, and all of the drug policy reformers will be out of work. And while they may be out of work, we shouldn't pity them too much. I would imagine that many of them will be gearing up to run for elected office on the coattails of their success in the drug policy arena. But that's neither here nor there. Again, Chris Crane, former executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. We're going to talk about drug policy, obviously, and we're going to get Chris's fresh opinion on how the drug policy reform arena is operating now that he's at least temporarily on the outside, waiting to start up a new position here in the next week or two. So we're going to press the old Skype button here and give Chris a call. So Chris Crane, past executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, will be on the line just briefly, or in just a couple seconds, I think.
Hello?
Hey, hello, Chris. Daniel Williams, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Daniel?
Well, pretty good. I want to thank you for spending some time and coming inside the Opium Den this morning.
And, absolutely. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the segment here, you're a valued friend of the show. You've been on once before. We had a great time, and your interview was one of the top five downloads out of the Opium Den archive. So apparently you have some...
Well, hopefully we'll beat that this time around.
Well, that's the plan, my friend. Maybe it'll require more profanity, more outrageous remarks. But anyway, we'll see.
We'll work on this.
We'll work on that. As I mentioned at the top of the interview in my introduction, that you are past executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and you served in that capacity very well. As I mentioned to my listeners, I think you're one of the smartest young men in drug policy reform, and I'm sure you've got a great future ahead of you in drug policy, although I hope it doesn't last forever, because that would mean we're not making any great progress in repealing drug prohibition and some of the silliness. But I'm sure you're going to do...
I appreciate that.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Good luck, but, you know, fuck
we're,
you.
We're all working to put ourselves out of business here. So,
well, you know,
that's the real measure of success.
Well, sometimes I'm not so sure if that's exactly the truth when I look at some of our drug policy reform leaders, if, in fact, they're really trying to put themselves out of work.
Well, I'll withhold comments on that one.
Okay. Well, just to start off here, when we spoke last, or actually not last, but several times ago, you told me that you had decided to move on from SSDP, and that you had a couple of options that you were going to explore, but mostly you were going to spend the month of August just in R&R mode. So my first question is, are you all tan, relaxed and ready, like the old Nixon T-shirt used to say?
I am. I've honestly been doing a lot more work this month than I anticipated. I'm doing a little bit of consulting work for a couple organizations, mainly actually still doing consulting for SSDP because our Higher Education Act elimination penalty campaign has really been in full swing. And there's a very good chance that we're going to get this this policy repealed in the next month or two. This is, for those who don't know, the law that denies federal financial aid eligibility to any student with a drug conviction. So SSDP has sort of kept me on a contract basis, doing some part-time work to help shepherd this process through Congress and make sure that we get the most favorable result.
Well, that's great. That's very cool. So what I'd like to start off with tonight or this afternoon is since this is the interview portion of the Opium Den, what I try to do here is, I get a lot of RSS feeds on stories that are written about the drug war, drug prohibition and the like, and, you know, there's been quite a number of them. What I do every time I read one, I contact the author and ask them if they would be interested in coming inside the Opium Den and doing an interview with regards to their views on the drug war and drug prohibition. And it's always interesting. No one ever agrees to come in. They use a variety of reasons. One being that it was just a story that I had to write, and I don't have a lot of interest in the article or in the issue. And the others say, "Well, I'd love to do it, but my contract forbids me from speaking out on radio shows and things like that." So I was never able to get any of these reporters. But there's a reporter in Canada by the name of Diane Francis, and she is one of the most recognized, respected financial investigative journalists in Canada, very widely known, very widely respected, the author of 9 best-selling books. And she wrote an article recently about the summit in Mexico between Stephen Harper, Felipe Calderon, and our own Barack Obama. And she labeled it the Three Amigos Summit, which I thought was pretty good. But anyway, I contacted her, and to my surprise, again, she's one of the most recognized people in Canada and biggest celebrity in the pool that I was trying to fish from. She agreed to do it, and I thought that was really great. But what I'm trying to get to here is when I did my pre-interview with Diane, she made her views known, and most of them were repeated during the interview. But one thing she said to me, she goes, "Daniel," she goes, "please, because I'm such a public figure, please don't ask me if I've had any experience with recreational drugs." And because she asked me not to ask the question, she pretty much answered the question from the get-go. But my point is, she is a part of the conspiracy of silence of our journalists and pundits out there who, when they speak of the drug issue, don't speak from any type of personal experience. They tend to toe whatever line that their company requires of them. And I just think that's one arena where if people like Chris Matthews, Joe Scarborough, some of the more prominent talking heads would actually admit to their own past or continuing drug use and try to change the direction. So my question is, why do you think that these individuals are so opposed to speaking the general truth and the personal truth that they have about drug use and drug prohibition? Why do you think that is?
That is an excellent question. I can't say I know the reason for sure, and I think it probably differs depending on who we're talking about here. My guess is that with folks like Chris Matthews or Scarborough or some of these media types, that they're probably prohibited from talking about this by the media conglomerates that they work for. I would bet you they would take a lot of heat from their parent corporations if they came out and they spoke about their own personal drug use. And it might be because these companies want to just sort of stay away from that in general, or they think it would tarnish their image. That might be the reason. They also might think that it would make them less objective as a journalist. And so they wouldn't want them talking about their personal views. They can only talk about it from a sort of a political, theoretical standpoint.
Well, on the objectivity level, I don't think Chris Matthews and some of these other cable news commentators actually profess to have much objectivity. Chris Matthews is quite the Obama sycophant, but not just so much maybe not talking about their own personal use, but trying to change the tone of the debate and speak not with reverence about the people who use recreational drugs responsibly, but to speak in a more honest fashion about the perceived threats of drug use and why we're on the wrong road here about it, and just maybe speak more generally about people who do use drugs recreationally and speak not so much in a reverent tone, but a less ridiculing and in a less condescending manner. I think that they would have the ability to change the debate, and I'm wondering if they can't say anything nice or can't say anything honest, why do they report on drug issues, do you think? Is that part of the corporate line? They have to report on them, but they can't speak a more more objective, honest truth?
That would certainly be my guess. I mean, I've never, you know, I don't know what the documents, the orders from, you know, corporate headquarters say, but that would certainly be my guess on this. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, whenever there's a story on one of these major cable news networks about marijuana or about the drug war, they're always the same. I remember, you know, Marijuana Inc. came out on CNBC a few months ago, and then just last month, CNN did a five-part series on Anderson Cooper's show on marijuana, which promised to, you know, look at this from a whole different point of view. And both of those were basically the same story that we've seen over and over and over again for, you know, at least as long as I've been involved in this, for, you know, 10 or 12 years or so. Just looking at reading some of the articles and seeing some of the reports that were done even before I got involved, it's basically been the same thing. There's a need to have so-called balance in their stories, and so they bring on the opposition without putting their, you know, without putting their point of view in context. There's almost always that same, you know, let's ride along in a helicopter and go on a raid and listen to what the agents have to say about, you know, what they're doing, without putting any of it in context, without talking about the impact that this has on the lives of individual users, without talking about the impact that this actually has on the supply of drugs or of marijuana in this country. And so you tend to see the same kinds of stories over and over and over and over again, which makes me tend to believe that this is basically mandated by these media conglomerates, that this is how you have to cover these stories. Because I just can't imagine that all of these journalists who are very smart, very bright individuals, very well accomplished, that none of them get it. It's impossible to imagine that. I don't think it's only a matter of them not being able to take the personal risk. I think that they probably have orders that, you know, they have to cover these stories a different way. That would certainly be my guess. But again, it's an educated guess, but it's as much a guess as anybody's.
Well, I think it's pretty accurate, actually, and that's been my thinking on the issue as well. But I wanted to get your thoughts. And with regards to, we'll stay on this theme for a second. You know who PJ O'Rourke is, obviously. And
sure.
PJ, I like him. He's a couple years older than I am. He's 62 years old, but he's from my generation. So we share a lot of the same cultural knowledge, cultural influences and the like. And, PJ O'Rourke, he's a satirist. He can be pretty good. I like reading him sometimes. Other times I think he's a little off his mark, but that happens to all of us. We never always bring our A game to the table, even though we like
to. Sure.
But in the recent Weekly Standard, I get that News Weekly because it's always nice to know what's going on both sides of the aisle. And in their books and arts section, P.J. O'Rourke actually has two articles in this week's edition. So he's, you know, out there buying a new car, but in the books and arts section, P.J. he decided to review the three recent books out to commemorate Woodstock turning 40. And I don't really agree with him that much in this article, but it was titled Sex, Drugs, Music, Mud, Woodstock at 40. And P.J. O'Rourke is another one of those journalists that doesn't speak the honest truth about drugs, and he doesn't seem to have any contractual obligations. He certainly doesn't work for a network, and whenever P.J. O'Rourke does speak about it, he speaks about it in a kind of a condescending, nod and a wink type of way. But just one point I wanted to make about this and get your feelings on it. PJ O'Rourke talks about wanting to go to Woodstock. That was one of the things that he was planning to do. But unfortunately, he wasn't able to get there, and the article describes how his girlfriend at the time made a feeble attempt at committing suicide, and so they didn't go up to the show. And the whole tone of the article is kind of condescending, but it's also a very revealing, at least for folks who live in the area that he is speaking of. He was talking about back in 1969, he was 21 years old, and he was smitten with a girl that he will call Sunflower to, I guess, protect the guilty. But he was smitten with a young girl named Sunflower, and he had gone to Long Island on his motorcycle, and he was going to, with the idea of Sunflower riding on the back all the way up to a Woodstock music and arts fair. So that was his goal. But what I think is revealing, it says in the article that PJ writes that according to this Woodstock music and arts fair, this was according to a poster in a record shop back in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Now, I'm from Fairborn, Ohio, and Yellow Springs is right down the road, literally about 5 miles away, and that was the home of Antioch College. Back in 1969, Antioch College was an absolute freak show. They were epicenter in the Midwest for all of the anti-war, you know, freewheeling sex and drugs, and it was quite a wild campus. So if P.J. O'Rourke was back in Yellow Springs in the summer of 1961 on a motorcycle, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that he was fucking stoned out of his mind half of the time. Not only there, but wherever he was as a student back then. So I just think, you know, it's funny that he makes light of the whole Woodstock deal, and there are certainly, you know, some laughter there, but he is a part of the conspiracy as well, and it doesn't fall inside the lines of controlled by, you know, the media and the like. So when we have a guy like that not willing to come out and not defend drug use per se, but at least put it in proper perspective, why would you think why do you think people like that are afraid to make the leap and help change the direction of the debate?
Well, I you know, I wouldn't be so sure that he's not under those kinds of constraints. I mean, he writes for the Weekly Standard, which has not exactly been the most friendly publication, at least of late, when it comes to these issues. So I'm not quite sure that that's the case. But, you know, to be honest, I'm really not sure, although I think that you're kind of getting at it when you're talking about Woodstock and Antioch and so forth. I think that there's so much of this issue is still wrapped up in the culture wars of the 1960s and the backlash to the hippie generation and the, you know, the freewheeling, drug taking, free sex ethos of the time. That, you know, even a lot of the people that were involved in that, somebody like P.J. O'Rourke may have, you know, he may well have smoked pot during those days and been involved in it to a degree, but eventually got kind of turned off to it. And the people who got turned off to that sort of culture as a whole then tend to take this sort of condescending, almost joking approach to drugs where they sort of just write it off and don't take the issue seriously. And I think it's something that the drug policy reform movement has really been trying to get past for the last 40 years, is allowing this this issue to be framed in terms of the culture wars. And we certainly see that all the time from our opposition, and when they're successful in framing this in terms of culture wars, it makes people who may well be on our side, who may well have had experience with drugs in the past, personal experience with drugs in the past, it probably makes them less likely to advance this cause politically, to advance this cause through their writing, through their reporting, because they don't want to be seen as, you know, sort of siding with the hippies in the culture war. And, you know, I think it's one thing that's been kind of nice, at least initially, about, you know, Obama getting elected and that he was sort of the first post-boomer generation president, and that we can get beyond framing every social issue in terms of these sort of outdated culture wars. Certainly this is not an issue for my generation, I don't think it's an issue for Obama's generation, but it is still something that is so prevalent in our national discourse, not just on drugs, but on most social issues. And until we're able to get beyond this, you know, culture warrior nonsense and these, you know, these remnants of these culture wars from 40 years ago, we're going to have a hard time getting people who are somewhat moderate or in the middle to really think clearly about these issues without having their judgment clouded by, you know, this sort of inflammatory rhetoric from both sides.
Well, that's a pretty good thought. But you mentioned drug policy reform, and what I'd like to move on to now, and since you're kind of a free agent, I know you've got a couple of things in the hopper, but you're still a free agent. So I'd like to get your thoughts and share with our listeners today. What do you believe the current state of drug policy reform is?
Well, I think it's been a pretty exciting year. I mean, I guess it depends on, you know, what you think is realistic to achieve in a relatively short amount of time. I think this has been, you know, certainly the best year for drug policy reform that I've seen in my 12 years being involved in this issue. If you had asked me, for instance, 3 years ago, if we were to get a Democratic administration and a Democratic-controlled Congress, what are the issues that you think we could get done that we might be able to get done in the first year? Right? I probably would have said reforming crack powder sentencing policy, repealing the HEA aid elimination penalty that denies financial aid to students with drug convictions, repealing the bar amendment that prevents D.C. from enacting their own medical marijuana law, and repealing the federal needle exchange ban. Those were, I would have sort of identified as the low-hanging fruit as far as federal drug policy is concerned. I'm not the type that's under the illusion that would be able to end everything all at once very quickly. But I would have identified sort of those are probably the easiest targets when it comes to the federal drug law.
Well, of those four pieces of low-hanging fruit, what has been picked from the tree?
They're all in the process right now of being picked. I mean, none of them are completely done, but they're all well on their way and very, very close.
I thought there was already specific legislation that was passed that expressly forbid the needle exchange program.
No, it's a complicated issue. What's happened so far? They've in the House so far has lifted the federal needle exchange ban. The Senate has yet to take it up, but they're expected to do so. There's two different issues here that people tend to confuse. There's D.C.'s needle exchange ban, and there is the federal needle exchange ban. It's almost certain that this year they're going to lift the prohibition on needle exchange programs nationwide, or spending federal money on needle exchange programs nationwide. They're also likely to do this in D.C. as well, because D.C. or Congress has ultimate oversight over the District of Columbia. We're the least democratic place in the country here in the nation's capital. The problem with that is that they put in restrictions on lifting D.C.'s federal needle exchange ban that would make it almost impossible to actually enact the needle exchange program in the district, because it would have to be like 1,000 feet from a park, a school, a church, a residence, like that. And if you actually look at any areas in town that are more than 1,000 feet from any of the places where it's prohibited, there's only like a couple of blocks in the city where you'd be able to do this. They put some unnecessary restrictions on it. But it is very likely that the needle exchange ban, a federal needle exchange ban at least, is going to be lifted this year, and D.C. is likely going to be allowed to spend their own city funding on needle exchange programs as well. So that's a really positive development.
But you would think with such a controversial subject like that, I mean, giving clean needles to junkie IV drug users seems to be more of a polarizing subject than just, you know, decriminalizing marijuana or taking marijuana out of Schedule One.
I don't think it really is, to be honest.
You think it's an easier sell?
I do. I actually do think it's an easier sell because it's a public health issue. You know, needle exchange is not something that's caught up in these culture wars that I talked about, whereas marijuana is. We talk about decriminalizing marijuana. We're talking about a very politically charged issue, whereas I don't think needle exchange is actually quite as politically charged. It's certainly not as culturally charged as marijuana is. And needle exchange can be framed in terms of a public health issue. It's purely a public and purely a public health issue. Not so much a drug issue at all. It's a matter of preventing the spread of HIV, hepatitis C, and other bloodborne infections. And all of the research shows that it's highly effective at preventing the transmission of bloodborne infections, and that it doesn't increase drug use. So I think from a public health perspective, it's probably an easier sell than marijuana decriminalization, which is just so culturally, politically charged.
Well, that's a good, interesting point. I hadn't thought it in that perspective, but you may be on to it right there. So with our drug policy reform leaders that we have out there, where do you see them taking the issue of drug policy reform? Are we going to stay on the same path with a little deviation, or do we need to believe some of the writings that have been coming out from DPA and others that this is an historic moment? This is our time. We are going to make great strides. And if you know, other than just boilerplate rhetoric, do you think that there actually is a breakthrough that we're going to experience? I certainly don't think so in the first Obama administration, and there may not be a second one if he doesn't get his shit together. But what sense do you get of our drug policy reform leaders and how they feel this is going to unfold? Is it still the hard slog that they've been talking about, or are they hopeful that there actually will be some significant fundamental movement here?
Well, I think both. I mean, I think it is still a hard slog. It's always this issue is always going to be a tough fight, and I don't think anybody's lost sight of that. But I also think there is tremendous reason to be hopeful. I mean, as I said to you, we're really picking off the low hanging fruit here in the first year. I think you're absolutely right that we're probably not going to see any major fundamental sort of paradigm shift in this issue, at least in Obama's first term. I think there's potential there in the second term, but certainly in the first term, I don't think he's going to do anything that he would see as damaging his chances of getting reelected, and also it's certainly not a major policy priority for him. With he's identified healthcare, education, green energy as being his major priorities, and I don't think he's going to take on anything that's being seen as highly controversial that might derail these other initiatives. So I think that we need, as far as the federal law is concerned, I think the drug policy organizations are going to continue to go after the policies that we have a real chance at reforming over the next 3.5 years or so. And I think something that we talked about on the last show, I think one of the things that a lot of the groups are going to be pushing for is passage of Jim Webb's bill that would create a presidential level commission to study our entire criminal justice system, and to look at a real overhaul of the criminal justice system.
Exactly the next point on my pad here to discuss with you. So let's talk about Jim Webb's National Criminal Justice Commission Act of 2009. Bring us up to date as to where that legislation actually is sitting, and secondly, when do you think it will actually become law and we can start?
Well, it's right now sitting, I believe it's in the a Crime and Justice Committee in the Senate, to be honest, I'm not 100% certain if it's been introduced in the House yet, but if it hasn't been introduced in the last few weeks, it's going to very, very shortly. They have a sponsor in the House, they've lined up co-sponsors in the House. It's already got something like 40 co-sponsors in the Senate, so it's got a tremendous amount of support. I mean, that's an unbelievable number of co-sponsors for a Senate bill, and they're going to have a large number of co-sponsors in the House as well when that's introduced, if it hasn't already been, and forgive me for not being completely up to speed on that one.
No, well, you've been on vacation.
pretty much. I actually do anticipate that this bill is going to pass probably this year, although it's difficult to get anything passed while the healthcare debate is going on. So, I mean, it might have to wait until after healthcare unless they decide to postpone healthcare for a few months and deal with some other business. I think this is going to pass probably this year, if not sometime next year. But I think there's an extremely high likelihood that this commission bill gets passed and the commission gets set up. And I do agree with some of the drug policy reform leaders that this is a good bill for the community to get behind. If we recognize that we're not likely to see any sort of major paradigm shift in the first term of the Obama administration, but there's a possibility that we could get some really serious reforms in a second term, then this commission plays right into that. Because once the commission is formed, they're going to have to study this issue for 2 years and come up with a set of recommendations after 2 years of studying it, which will put us right at, or basically right after the next presidential election.
Well, the, you have the, yeah, so yeah, the commission, I think, you know, anytime an effort is made that's in a positive direction, it's very hard to criticize. But I've been around a long time, and we talked about this last time, and I saw the Blue Ribbon Commission that Nixon had, and the Blue Ribbon Commission that Carter had, and the Blue Ribbon Commission that Ford had, and they all came to the conclusion that marijuana should be at minimum decriminalized and possibly legalized. And so I would think that if Webb's commission has any integrity, they're going to come up with at least a similar recommendation that marijuana should be decriminalized or legalized. But in that vein, knowing that that's probably at minimum going to be one of the recommendations, why don't you think President Obama, using Webb as his cover, could at the bare minimum take marijuana out of Schedule 1 and put it into Schedule 2, and perhaps limit or end all federal funding for local marijuana prohibition initiatives? Why don't you think he could use Webb's deal as a cover to lessen the trauma that's going to be incurred by probably, you know, 1.5 million Americans, mostly younger ones, who will be arrested for the simple possession of marijuana while Webb is studying this? Why don't the drug policy reform leaders put some pressure on the White House in that regard with the simple common sense logic that, of course, decriminalization, if not legalization, is going to be one of the requirements? Why don't you just, you know, be proactive and do something now to lessen the pain during that time? I don't see anything about that from our drug policy reform leaders. Why is that not a priority?
I honestly don't think it's realistic that Obama would do that until he has the actual recommendations from the commission. I mean, that said, we have been pressuring the administration to do exactly that, particularly when it comes to, you know, not interfering with state medical marijuana laws, which they've actually been pretty good on.
Well, there was another bust, but there was another bust about 10 days ago out in California.
There was, and from everything that I understand, that was the clubs that were busted were the kinds that even the drug policy reform movement is not really behind. These were clubs that were not operating even in accordance with the California Attorney General's guidelines. There are guidelines that are in place both from the Attorney General in California and from the legislature in California that all the clubs are supposed to abide by.
But aren't they pretty vague, though? I mean, aren't they kind of ambiguous and vague, and that's part of the problem?
No, not so much anymore. The Attorney General guidelines that came out last year are much more succinct than what they'd had before. So there are rules in place that these dispensaries are supposed to abide by, and a lot of people in California still think it's kind of the Wild West, like it was a few years ago, where they can just go and open up any dispensary they want, operate it as a for-profit business, and make tons of money. And that's no longer the case. And the Obama administration was very clear when they made their statement about the Justice Department's policy on state medical marijuana laws, that they're not going to interfere in any dispensaries or any state medical marijuana laws as long as they're operating under accordance with state law. And from what I understand, these places were not operating in accordance with state law. And so it was a joint state-federal effort when they went in and busted them. I don't believe that anybody should be busted for selling marijuana, period. I'm all for ending marijuana prohibition. I think we need a legal, regulated system for marijuana. But, you know, we have an administration that's come in and said, you know, we're going to be much better on this issue than our predecessor. We're not going to interfere with clubs that are operating in accordance with state law. And if somebody's going to then basically press their luck, it's hard to really defend their actions given the framework that the administration has given them, which they're giving a lot of leeway here to these states to enact sensible medical marijuana laws, and they're giving a lot of leeway to the clubs to open as long as they're operating in accordance with their state laws.
But isn't it also true though, Chris? And you make a very good point. But isn't it also true, what you say about no one should be arrested for selling or profiting on marijuana? I agree with that. But isn't it true also that the whole medical marijuana deal in California and the other 12 states, it's not that it's a sham, but I read estimates anywhere from 80% to 95% of people with medical marijuana cards do it just so they can smoke legal pot. They're not really really sick. So if we've got that kind of gaming of the system already in place, doesn't it make the whole idea of busting these shops and following regulations and doing it by the book, doesn't it make it more make it less of trying to make sure the law is followed and more of just trying to continue to harass people who are in the medical marijuana business? Because the police, everybody knows that it's kind of a scam. Everybody's gaming the system. And do you think that they're using that mentality more so than, well, you know, their form 603.5 wasn't filled out exactly correct, and we think that
it's not a matter of, you know, one form wasn't filled out correctly. It's that they're not operating. There's all of these dispensaries are now supposed to be operating in nonprofit models, which is a good thing, which is a very good thing. You know, they have some pretty sensible regulations now in place that the dispensaries are supposed to follow. It'd be similar to saying, you know, the government sets up a distribution system for pharmaceutical drugs. If a pharmacist is then just is completely flaunting the laws that are in place for distributing pharmaceutical drugs and sort of distributing them to anybody they want and making major money off of it, is saying that, well, you know, just because people are gaming the system, we should just let them get away with it. I can kind of understand where the government's coming from in that respect, and that there are some clubs out there that are really flaunting the law. And, you know, given the fact that this administration has actually given a lot more than the Bush administration or the Clinton administration on this issue, it would be very wise for the people involved in the medical marijuana industry in California to abide by the regulations. Don't press your luck, and don't force the administration into a corner where they're going to come in and raid these clubs because they publicly stated this is our policy now. So I fully agree. I think that we need a legal, regulated distribution system for recreational use and not only medical marijuana use. But as long as that is the case, it makes sense to have some sort of sensible regulations. And I don't want to see some clubs out there operating that are flaunting the system and making things more difficult for people who are operating legitimately. And trying to preserve the integrity of the system.
Let me ask you this: if I don't mean to interrupt you there, but it's my show.
No, it's your show. Go right ahead.
let me a personal question, and again, you can defer if you wish. But if you lived in California, would you get a medical marijuana recommendation?
It's a tough question. I might, this is a real difficult question about what use is medical use. Now, some states, it's really hard to, as you say, game the system, but some states are very specific about which conditions you have to qualify for a medical cannabis ID card. There are some states where this isn't really an issue at all. There are others, like California, where the law is much more vague, and they don't specify, what conditions you need. Now, somebody who comes home from work, they work a long, hard day, right, they come home after work, and they sit down and they smoke a joint instead of having, a cocktail or something, right? Now, that would be under probably the traditional definition, that would probably be considered recreational use, right? It's somebody who's coming home and they're winding with a joint. But couldn't you make a legitimate case that that's also medical use?
I've been making that case for 40 years that smoking marijuana is
a really hard day at work.
It's preventative. It's a preventative type of medicine. It's also a soothing medicine when you have difficulties. To say that marijuana is only medicinally applied if you have an ailment tends to ignore the other proposition that smoking marijuana can be a preventative, a wellness type of thing, just like walking around the block every morning for your health.
That's right. That's right. So, when you say that, 70% to 80% or 80% to 90% are sort of gaming the system, I don't really think that's correct. I think a lot of these people are using it for stress relief. A lot of these people are using it for chronic pain where they won't necessarily look like, they won't look like a patient necessarily. They won't be gaunt or, you know, they won't have, they're not necessarily going to be in a wheelchair or limping around or anything like that. But if they're using it to relieve stress, if they're using it for insomnia, if they're using it to treat migraine headaches, which it's extremely beneficial for, they're not necessarily going to look like your typical patient, but they certainly are using it for medical use. And so it's really hard for any of us to judge, you know, whose use is really medical and whose use is non-medical.
Well, my son, who lives up in Portland, Oregon, and is just graduating this year from the Pacific Northwest College of the Arts, which I'm giving him a plug, and his school. Apparently, it's a fairly prestigious school. If the tuition is any indication, it's a real good fucking school. But he'll be graduating, and you know, with my history, you know, I've been using drugs recreationally almost 40 years now, and was arrested twice in college for drugs. So I was always very honest, much to his mother's chagrin, but always very honest with my son about drugs as he was growing up. And he's a pretty sober young man. He's 29 years old now. He drinks on occasion, he'll smoke on occasion, but he's a fairly sober guy, and I think that's probably part his own decision-making process, but also part of being honest and talking about drugs to him from an age where it was appropriate and allowed him to get away from some of the peer pressure. But to the point, he was in Los Angeles recently. A friend of his got married, so he went down to L.A. To the wedding, and hadn't been to Los Angeles in, you know, over 10 years, 12 years. And his friend that was getting married is a stand-up, does stand-up comedy and things like that. And he's a medical marijuana patient. And, you know, he's, I don't want to say gaming the system, but he said, you know, what the hell? If I got to go to the doctor, tell him I got stress from being a stand-up comedian and the like, and marijuana helps. And that's what he did, and he got the deal. But my son was able to, and this was the first time he was immersed in this type of culture, I guess, the medical marijuana thing. So he went around, with his friend, he went to the dispenser where his buddy gets his medical marijuana. And they purposely went towards the end of the day because the patient had convinced his supplier, his distributor there at the clinic, to allow my son Daniel to come in and, you know, look around and see what a medical marijuana dispensary was all about. So they went, and my son, you know, he was all excited when he talked to me. He says, Dad, he said, I couldn't believe it was very clean, like just like a doctor's office. You know, there's security. You had to go. You could only go so far if you didn't have a medical marijuana card. And he was very impressed about it. And the guy closed up the shop and gave him the tour. He got past the security line that if you don't have a card, you can't get in. So he was able to get a full tour of the place. And he said where all the pot was very clear, very brightly lit, and all the pot was were in the little, you know, brown pill bottles and the like. So it was a very classy operation. And the guy at the end gave my son and his friend a joint. And my son smoked all. So he'd never been that high in his life because he barely, you know, smokes a whole joint. But the point that I'm progressing to is that the price of pot was extremely high. Now, here in Bonita Springs, Florida, where I live, a good, you know, an ounce of top grade hydroponic goes for anywhere from $400 to $450. And there in California, in these dispensaries, that same pot was running, you know, $350, $375. So I did a little experiment, and stay with me here, but I did a little experiment and trying to figure out what would be a good retail price for cannabis in a regulated market. And what I did is I compared it to tobacco. Tobacco and cannabis are roughly the same as far as degree of difficulty in growing. It's not hard to grow tobacco. It's not easy to grow tobacco. But at the end of the day, they're both about the same cost to grow the product. And you can buy, I bought a pack of cigarettes, hundreds, which are a little bit longer than normal. I stripped all the tobacco out of it, and this particular pack of cigarettes called Sundancer, one of the low-cost brands that people are migrating to with the new tobacco taxes. But there was 20 grams of tobacco. That's not counting the paper and the filters and everything, but just tobacco, 20 grams. And my tobacco guy sells that pack of cigarettes for $3. So my question is, When we do get this regulated market, how much tax is actually going to be fair? How much is going to be tolerated? And what do you think would be a good price? these guys out in California paying $350, $375 for an ounce of high grade pot, I think is a sin. And I don't know if they're being supplied by clandestine markets or what, but there's no reason that an ounce of pot, high quality pot, should cost more than, you know, $100, $125. What are your thoughts on that?
There actually are perfectly good reasons given the current system. Now, if we were looking at a legal regulated market for everybody, a nationwide legal market where you're not just talking medical, then I think you're probably right. I think $100 to $125 for an ounce of high-grade marijuana is probably going to sound about right. They could probably even do it for less, but
I would think
the taxes would bump it up. I'm sure whatever companies were selling it or not-for-profits were selling it, whatever model there was, you know, would inflate the prices a little bit to bring their profit margins up and so forth. Pay the, you know, you're going to have staff over, you know, overhead and production overhead and so forth. So, you know, I think you've probably got a pretty good estimate about what it would be in a real legal regulated market. The problem is in this dispensary market or the medical marijuana market. There's a couple of reasons why the prices are as high as they are. One is that there is it's a very much a gray area as to where the dispensaries can get their marijuana. So most of them are many of them are getting it from the black market, or you could really say gray market in this case. And so somebody's growing, unless they just really care about patients and really care about this issue. They're basically, you know, growers basically faced with the choice of, you know, do I sell to a dispensary for far less than I would get on the black market? Most people are not going to do that, and so a lot of these dispensaries, when they're buying their cannabis or medicine, they have to be able to compete with the black market prices. Otherwise, they're never going to be able to stock their medicine. And so that's, I think, the major reason why the prices are so high. The other problem is, and you started seeing this actually in the earlier days of some of the dispensaries, is that they actually tried to really bring the prices down. Some of the ones, especially some of the ones that had their own grow facilities, which some of them do actually just have their own facilities to grow and they supply their own, in which case they could bring the prices down. What a lot of these places found early on, and these are good people that I'm talking about, these are not, you know, dispensaries that are, you know, being opened up by people who are trying to game the system. These are really good people who opened, you know, good dispensaries, well-meaning, and they wanted to bring the prices down because they know it's artificially inflated. And what they found was that people were going into the dispensaries, they were buying an ounce or so of marijuana at, $150 an ounce or so, and then leaving the store, going a couple blocks away, and selling it for $400 an ounce on the street. And so if your prices are so much lower than the black market prices, then you're looking at a system where a lot of your product, a lot of your medicine is going to be diverted into the black market.
Yeah, but under that scenario, maybe initially you can buy it for $150 from the dispenser and sell it on the street for $400. But once that practice becomes more widespread, you have greater competition, that $150 to $400 delta is going to shrink dramatically to where you could only, you know, maybe get $175. It's the same thing with alcohol or cigarettes.
You can't go out and buy
a six pack of beer and then sell it. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, it's possible, but because you're going to have this, you know, you are going to have this both the medical market and the black market, and it would take a while to get there. And in the meantime, communities freak out when they find out that, you know, the marijuana that's being sold in their streets is coming from dispensaries. And so you're literally creating a situation where the entire medical cannabis system can be shut down completely because so much has been diverted into the black market. So I don't really think you have the time to get there where you reach that sort of critical mass that it also brings down the prices in the black market. It's really too large of a risk for most of these dispensaries to take.
So they keep the prices artificially high to discourage street dealing, but doesn't that penalize the patient? I mean, isn't that kind of a catch-22?
To a degree, unfortunately, it does. But if they don't do that, then the communities shut them down, and then there's no supply for the patients, and the patients are back to the black market. So it's far from a perfect system, and it's not 100% fair. But I do understand the rationale behind it. And again, there's also the issue of they have to get their marijuana from this gray market, and the growers that they're buying from. You know, if the dispensaries aren't paying close to black market prices, then the growers have no incentive to sell to them because they can make so much more selling directly to the black market.
Well, then in
a
regulated market, then let's look past just the narrow scope of medical marijuana, but in the broader context of all prohibitions against marijuana being removed. That would obviously impact the price dramatically, because that would eliminate the, you know, buying it for $150 and selling it for $400. If you go walk into a marijuana retailer, whether you're buying it, I mean, medicinal wouldn't matter at that point anymore. Everyone would be able to buy it. I believe that the prices would come down in an extraordinary fashion. Again, comparing pot and tobacco, if a tobacco retailer can make money selling 20 grams of tobacco for $3, there has got to be, even if the tax burden was insanely high, I can't imagine buying an ounce of high-grade pot for more than $75. You know, could you? I mean, given the fact
I think you're probably right. I think you are probably right. I mean, I'm trying to explain why the prices are so high under the current system,
right?
Which is a medical cannabis system. And I think there are some really legitimate reasons for that. But I think you're right. I think if there's a legal regulated market for everybody, and there is no real distinction between medical and recreational, I think that will drive the prices down. That will probably drive the prices down a lot, unless it's done in a way in which there are, you know, prohibitively high taxes. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the bill that's currently pending in the Massachusetts state legislature, which would tax and regulate marijuana for recreational use, it would impose a $200 tax on every ounce of marijuana sold.
Well, that's going to work.
So, you know, it was a great revenue boost for the state. But,
yeah, they spend 40 years hunting us down to throw us in jail and ruining our lives, and then say, okay, well, we're sorry for all that, but now we're going to fuck you from the financial side and make you pay the same price you used to pay when we were hunting you down. I mean, can't they?
Right, exactly.
Can a poor stoner get a break? I mean, what the fuck?
And, you know, unfortunately, that may well be the way that the way that it's going to happen, because that may be the only way to make it palatable to politicians, is saying, look how much money you can make if you put these outrageously high taxes per ounce in a recession economy. That may become more and more politically palatable to state legislators around the country. So that may wind up being the way that it actually ends up happening.
Yeah, it's the old scenario: fuck me once, fuck me twice. I mean.
I guess it's a matter of, you know, would you rather get screwed by going to jail or having to pay, you know, basically the same amount that you're paying now on the black market?
I've had experience in both, and trust me, having experience in both, I'd rather not go to jail again. If I gotta, you know, pay $400 for my hydroponic, then so be it. But this leads.
I think if most people were faced with the choice of. You can continue to pay $400, 400 ounce for high-grade marijuana and not go to jail, or you can pay $400 an ounce for marijuana and go to jail. I think most people are going to choose $400 and no jail.
But I also think, yeah, that's true. Sign me up for that fucking program.
Right.
Not to say
that this is ideal, but I think that most people would take that choice.
But I think the big danger there, and this is going to lead me into my next point that I'd like to follow up on, but the big danger of such a high-taxed system is that people will grow their own pot. I mean, if they're going to regulate the market and say, okay, well, you can't grow your own. Well, okay, fine. They can tell you that you can't grow your own. But in a regulated market, they're not going to be spending a lot of money looking for the guy who's got two plants grown in his back bedroom. So essentially, whether they tell you you can't grow your own.
People can brew their own beer.
Yeah, you're going to grow your own pot if the taxes are too excessive. And then you get into the problem of, well, why aren't we making any money on pot? And it's going to be because everybody's growing their own. But
most people won't grow their own.
No, they won't.
Because most people are either busy or they're lazy or they don't have the skills to do it. And most people are not.
Well, it's not brain surgery, man. It's not brain surgery growing hydroponic weed.
Well, I mean, that may be, but it's simply not. Like I said, some people are lazy, and some people are really busy, and they're not going to want to come home after a long, hard day and tend to their plants.
Well, speaking of the busy people, that's going to segue into my next point on the page here.
Sure.
I don't know if you saw it or not, but last week it was, and I just saw it across the crawl of one of the news channels. And I was sitting at home, and I got DVR, so I kept rewinding it to make sure I was reading it correctly. And it said that a report had come out. I don't know if it was a government report or a private report. I don't know whatever it was, but there was a report that came out that said we should expect a significant increase in marijuana consumption once the baby boomers retire. in essence, now that, yes, now that all these baby boomers who they say, you know, the conventional wisdom is if you live through the 60s, you can't remember them. But I don't think that's true at all. I think a lot of people who smoke pot of my generation, they quit because, one, they got out of college, got married, had kids, jobs. They didn't quit because they didn't like the effects or anything like that. They quit because, you know, literally they were too busy to do it, but it's still a fond memory. And now all these baby boomers are retiring. And the news crawl said they expect a significant increase in baby boomers smoking pot. So this, I think, is a very good thing. And it goes to the busy, too busy to do it, and pricing structure. A lot of baby boomers, you know, since they don't have to worry about random drug tests or their fellow employees looking down on them because they smoke pot, although they probably, if they talked more, they'd find they had more friends than foes by their fellow employees. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids are gone, long gone, they're on their own. Grandma and grandpa, they're going to want to smoke some dope. And
that's right, and they're going to get it from their grandkids.
No, they're not. That's the point that I'm going to make. That's the beauty of it. These fuckers are retired. They're going to, if they got to look at it, go, Jesus Christ, I'll just grow my own. You're going to have all
some
these.
Some of them will.
Yeah, all these green thumb grannies out there with thyme on their hands. They're going to grow pot, and you're going to see stories on the news of these little, you know, quaint and quintessential looking grannies with gray hair and, you know, kind of overweight and, you know, stooped over and talking about, you know, growing AK-47 or blueberry next to their fucking orchids and shit. And it's going to be a big deal. And the thing that's the ironic thing is, with the point that you made, you know, most of us boomers, I'm 59 years old, most of us older people, we get our dope from the younger crowd. You know, it's drugs are a young person's business, and it's usually a family member. So if we see all these grannies and grandpas starting to smoke pot, they got all the time on their hands. A lot of them are going to grow it because they're gardeners anyway. They're of that generation, you know, they gardened and all that kind of stuff. They're going to grow their own pot, and they're going to grow it for their friends, and they're probably going to grow it for their kids. And that's the dynamic that I think if we reverse that dynamic, that would make, you know, visiting the grandparents, you know, a whole new ball game. I think grandparents, some of these older baby boomers, are going to start cultivating pot for personal use and for their friends and the like. And you're going to see a huge issue there. And why I think it should be of concern to Obama is very simple. Grandma and grandpa vote. Young kids don't vote. The demographic of recreational drug users is 18 to 39, and most of them, unfortunately, don't vote. And Obama didn't get that many more of them than happened in 2004. But the grandmas and grandpas, they do vote. And I think it would be, again, wise on Obama's part to be preemptive and satisfy these grandmas and grandpas, because a lot of them believe, and I talked to a lot of them because I live down here in an old, wrinkled city, is that a lot of the baby boomers believe that some of their Social Security and Medicare benefits are going to be reduced going forward. And I think it would make sense for Obama to let grandma and grandpa get mellow before that shit hits the fan. And that way, you know, they may be disappointed, but they'll be able to say, well, we got fucked by Medicaid, but at least Obama made pot cheap and legal. And I make fun of that, but it's true.
There's absolutely some truth to that. I think the worry is that the, you know, sort of the generation above the boomers, who many of them are still alive.
They're all dead. No, I'm not.
They're in their 70s and their 80s, and they still vote.
Right.
And they are very much opposed to this. There's a big generation gap there.
Oh, I don't know, Chris. I'm not so sure. Again, I live down here with a bunch of old
polling,
people.
The polling on this is very clear. I mean, the generation before the boomers, very much opposed to marijuana legalization. With the boomers, it starts to change. And actually, among my generation, even more so than with the boomers, although that may well change as more and more of them retire. I mean, I think you're really hitting on something that's absolutely correct, and I've seen it anecdotally amongst, friends my parents who were starting to be in retirement age. I've had conversations with Keith Strappi, you know, executive director of Normal, former executive director of Normal, founder of Normal, and my former boss. And, you know, a few years ago, he turned 60 about 4 years ago or so. So he's, of the boomer generation, and so the first generation of boomers to retire, or first wave of boomers to retire, I should say. And he certainly started seeing friends of his who he's known for years and years and years who've never smoked marijuana, all of a sudden calling him up and saying, hey, you know, kids are out of the house and I'm retired now. Maybe we should hang out sometime, you know? Maybe I'd like to try this stuff again. I really enjoyed that back when I was in college.
Exactly.
I haven't really thought about it in 30 years. And a lot more of these people are sort of coming out of the woodwork. And I certainly see it anecdotally, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that. Because I think you're right. I think most of these people quit not because they didn't like it, but because life intervened, because they got busy, and because they had kids, and they got scared that if they smoked around their kids, that
right.
their kids were going to smoke, and they didn't want their kids to start smoking at 13, 14, or whatever. They started to become more prone to buying into some of the propaganda around it. But then once the kids are gone and they're retired, they don't have to worry about drug tests, and they don't have to worry about being outed at work or losing their job or anything like that. All of a sudden, they start thinking, man, you know, that was a lot of fun back in the day. I think I'd like to revisit that. And I think you are going to see a wave of that, and it might lead to more growing, but it's certainly going to lead to more, more retirees consuming, absolutely.
Well, the only downside of that is there's not much very attractive about a 75-year-old woman in a tie-dye T-shirt with no bra on. I mean, I don't know how far they're going to regress into their college personas, but there's.
I don't think they're going to regress quite that far. And you know what? That's probably a good thing, not just for the mental images involved, but for everybody else involved. Because if you see a tie dye granny, a granny tie dye in a headband and stuff like that, people are just going to laugh. But if you see a normal looking granny, who looks like your grandma or looks like your grandpa. Sitting in their recliner and smoking a joint, that changes the image of the marijuana smoker.
Oh,
and that actually helps us get away from that the sort of hippie image.
Absolutely.
And everything associated with the culture war when you have responsible older adults who look like grandparents. They look like your grandparents. They look like people that middle America and middle class and swing, basically swing voters can identify with. That really helps change the entire issue. I think that's probably overall a positive thing.
Oh, I think it's a very positive thing. I'm looking forward to it. And actually, I mean, I didn't see another blurb on the news, not a newspaper article, not a news magazine article, nothing that there was no follow-up on that, which I thought was...
I've heard nothing about it myself, so I have no idea where the study came from or how legitimate
it
was.
Yeah.
All I can go into is anecdotal evidence and just common sense. You have a whole generation of people who, many of whom used when they were younger and enjoyed it and, like you said, gave it up because of life. So I think there's... whether there's actual evidence to back it up or a legitimate study to back it up, I think that there's pretty strong, at least anecdotal and common sense evidence.
Yeah, exactly, common sense. The point you make about the generation above us, I started to dismiss it, but I as I'm sitting here listening to you, I'm rethinking it, and you're correct. There is a pretty significant reticence to acceptance in that age group, especially as they look down to the younger generation as they see it. But my I'm wondering if the people who are 5 years above the boomer thing, because there was a clear line of demarcation back then. If you were 18 and in college, you were a part of the deal, and if you were 22 back in 68 or 23, you might have just skirted the issue and been aware of it but not participated. So that generation probably does have a little more pejorative outlook on the word stoner. But I'm wondering if they're, especially down here, that group, all their neighbors, are young, younger people, but in their 60s and the like. I'm wondering if there'll be less resistance to it when they see, Marge, who lives next door, that is, 63 years old, comes over and talks to the lady who's 80 about marijuana, says, you know what, I'm smoking marijuana again. Do you think that age proximity will have an impact on the older people, strictly from a voting standpoint, or do we just need for them to die off before we can get this done?
It's probably a combination of both. to be honest. Of course there'd be some sort of impact. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why, an organization like The Normal is important in terms of, they're activating the cannabis consumers and encouraging people to sort of come out of the closet about their use. There's no doubt that when somebody knows a marijuana smoker, and knows them well, if it's a family member or a close friend, and they know this person is not a bad person, they know that they're responsible, that they have a good family, a good job, and so forth, that changes their view of marijuana smoking. It's very easy to demonize marijuana, or to demonize people who use marijuana, when your image is, you know, a burned out stoner on their, you know, in their parents' basement, or or a hippie, or a freak, or whatever. When people have that image in their heads, it's hard to blame them for being, you know, opposed to marijuana legalization, because they're scared. That's all they know. But when you change the image of who smokes marijuana from the sort of fringe types, at least according to, you know, and I'm not trying to denigrate hippies or
well, yeah, you better be careful there, brother. I resemble that remark.
Friends. Yeah, I'm not trying to denigrate them. I'm trying to talk from the, you know, from the point of view of a middle America, moderate, swing voter type.
Yeah.
Those people, unfortunately, are scary to them. If that's who they associate marijuana with, then they're much less likely to support, taxing and regulating or decriminalizing marijuana. But if the image then becomes their next door neighbor who they've known for 30 years, it becomes the 60-year-old woman who has glaucoma and is growing a couple plants in her backyard, or if it becomes their son or daughter who's in their 20s and relatively successful, who they love and they know is not a screw up, or their sister, or a family member, that changes the entire dynamic. And I think there's a strong parallel there between sort of marijuana consumers and the gay rights movement. Now, there's a difference in that. Obviously, consuming marijuana is entirely a choice, and I don't think somebody chooses whether or not they're gay.
Of course not.
So I certainly don't want to insult the integrity of the gay rights movement by implying that consuming marijuana, somebody consumes marijuana, defines who they are. But there certainly is a parallel in that, before the coming out of the closet movement, in the gay rights movement, they had a hard time sort of gaining any traction on very basic human rights issues, the fundamental right to be who they are, to exist and not to be arrested for being gay, let alone gay marriage and some of the issues that we've now gotten to. It took people coming out of the closet and being open about who they are, to change people's perception of homosexuals and homosexuality. Because it's really hard to demonize an entire class of people if one of them is somebody that you love. And I think that there's lessons to be learned there for cannabis consumers, especially those who are in positions to openly admit that they smoke. There are people that can't do that. There are people who are in jobs where they will absolutely lose their job if they admit that they smoke pot. They can't do that. I understand that. There are certain people who, kids may be under, surveillance by Child Protective Services and so forth, and they don't want to lose their kids because they've had issues with the law in the past and that kind of thing, and they're probably not in a position to say something. But the majority of people who use cannabis are in a position to just admit, at least to their family members and their closest friends, that they smoke marijuana. And I would bet you that when they do that, the majority of their friends and family members will say, you know what, so do I.
Yeah, that's the big surprise. That's the big surprise out there. The people who finally get the courage to talk to a coworker or a friend or somebody about their pot use, they finally get to screw up the courage to talk about it. And the first thing out of the person's mouth is, wow, you too? Hey, I get high as well. That's the great silent majority out there.
How many times do you hear stories about, a kid finally talks to their parents about the fact that they smoke pot, and your parent asks, where are you smoking? Oh, I'm smoking out the bathroom window into the courtyard. Oh, so am I. they've probably been smoking into the scene. I've probably been blowing right. Smoke into the same courtyard, hiding it from each other for the last 5 years.
And that's the oppression of 40 years of hardcore propaganda and lies. I mean, they make you feel like you're alone. They make you feel like you're dregs of society, and you don't want to make mention of your particular pleasures. And then when you do, you're shocked that everybody else agrees with you. So that's pretty
right.
Funny.
I think if more and more people were to be open about their marijuana consumption, especially if they're sort of responsible people with jobs and families, and people who are sort of their credibility is unassailable. I think the whole house of cards comes crashing down.
Yeah.
Because it's the kind of thing where nobody realizes how many people they know also use marijuana. They think they're the only one. And when they finally admit it, they start realizing that most people they know also do it.
Yeah, I think the estimates are low, actually. They say around 25 million, but I think I think it's closer to 40 to 45 million people who at least smoke pot occasionally, whether they're, you know, there are some who smoke every single day, obviously, but I think there are 40 million plus people out there who will use marijuana this year. When you got that many people doing it, it's pretty hard not to know somebody that that gets high. 40 million people.
I think you're probably right. I mean, I think there's no doubt that the estimates are low. I mean, these are the government's own surveys. You know, if somebody comes knocking on your door, hi, I'm with the federal government. I'd like to know if you
smoke marijuana. Well, of course I do. And by the way, I beat my old lady and fucked my dog. You know?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Right. So I think it's a pretty safe guess that the estimates are pretty low.
Yeah. So I want to move into the last segment here, and you did a nice job of giving me the segue when you were talking about image of, you know, people, stoners and things like that. What the image is all about. And I know that you've been a past speaker at the Seattle Hemp Fest, and you didn't have the opportunity to make it out there this year. I've been to the Hemp Fest myself, and I think it's a cool thing for what it is. But there's been some controversy inside the drug policy reform arena, and it was kicked off by your friend and an acquaintance of mine, Eric Sterling, who took the position that, in a nutshell, and I'll let you elaborate on it because you're better at it than I am. But in a nutshell, Eric Sterling felt that organizations and festivals like the Hemp Fest were counterproductive to the efforts of drug policy reform, because all they do is reinforce the stereotypical view that the public has of people who consume cannabis, that they're just a bunch of stoners and you know, run and listen to music and just do stupid, irresponsible shit. And I personally don't agree with Eric on that, but I want you to air that one out and give us some perspective and context, and whether you believe Eric is making a point or not.
Well, first to back up just a little bit, it actually wasn't Eric who started this discussion. It was actually Dominic Holden.
Well, that's true. I apologize. Yeah, get me straight.
Sure. Well, to give you the background of this, Dominic, who is also a close friend of mine, Dominic is the former director of HempFest. Him and Vivian McPeak were basically partners running the show for years. Dominic has since stepped away the last few years, and he's now a full-time writer at the Stranger, which is the largest weekly newspaper in Seattle, edited by Dan Savage. As Savage loves, some people may be familiar with him. He's on the news all the time.
Yeah, I know Dan Savage.
Yeah, and who's also a big supporter of ours, of this issue. And so, you know, Dominic is a good guy, and he's been very involved in HempFest. And he wrote an article for The Stranger basically criticizing the HempFest for being too hippie-friendly. And he wasn't even complaining necessarily that it was too marijuana-friendly, because it's a marijuana festival, or protestival, as they call it. But it was that it had too much of a hippie image, and that actually turns away your average marijuana smoker. Not even that it turns off your average middle-class American, or middle-America American, but that it turns off your average marijuana smoker who's not a hippie. And that, in fact, most of the people who come to HempFest, most of the attendees of HempFest, are not hippies. You know, they're younger guys, younger girls. You know, they're pretty much just normal young people. But certainly not necessarily counterculture types. And so the original criticism was basically that the festival, it caters too much to the counterculture at the expense of most people who actually use marijuana. So I think there's a little bit of validity to that. And I say this as somebody who, I love the Seattle Hemp Fest. I think it's probably the best marijuana-focused event that there is. And to get Eric's point, I think that there's some validity to Eric's point. I think a lot of the sort of marijuana festivals that go on around the country may well be counterproductive. I don't think that Seattle Hemp Fest is one of them. And I think that has to do with pure numbers more than anything. But I do think that there's something to the, you know, catering to this sort of counterculture hippie image that can be somewhat damaging. And it goes back to something that we were talking about earlier, in that for too long this debate over marijuana legalization or decriminalization has been sort of has been wrapped in the culture wars, and wrapped in the counterculture versus the culture, and wrapped in this 1960s culture wars, and that when these festivals are cater too much to the hippies and the counterculture, that it kind of only inflames that that sentiment. So I understand a bit where Eric's coming from with that. Now, that said, I think the pure size of the Seattle Hemp Fest actually has some really positive benefits to it, in that you have 250,000 people coming to this gigantic festival right in downtown Seattle, right on Puget Sound, right out in the open, with plenty of police there. There's plenty of police presence.
Oh, I know. I saw tons of them, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and the cops are there to actually maintain order and protect the public. They're not there to harass marijuana smokers, which is great. And it's really empowering for a lot of these people, especially a lot of these young people, college-age students, people in their 20s, of course, who come to this thing, to see that, there can be a gathering of people who smoke marijuana in a public setting, in a concert-type environment, in a fun, in a fun environment, and that and they're not worried about it. And there's no paranoia involved.
And there's no violence, and nobody dies, and there's no crazy.
There's no violence, and there's no arrest, and they then get to view the cops as somebody who are as people who are there to protect them rather than to harass them. And that changes the dynamic between young people and the police, which is incredibly important.
Right.
And it's also very liberating in that most people never really have the experience of seeing what legal marijuana would look like. I mean, unless they've been able to take a trip to Amsterdam, where they can go into a coffee shop and buy it and experience it that way. Most people really have no concept in their minds of what a world of legal marijuana would look like.
Right.
And so bringing somebody, especially somebody who's younger and sort of forming their views on this, to a festival like this where you've got over 100,000 people or a couple hundred thousand people all gathered, and people are smoking and they're happy and there's no problems with it and there's no arrests or anything like that, I think it's very empowering to them, and it shows them what's possible. And I think that it's a great way to recruit people to get involved in the efforts to end the war on drugs and to end the war on marijuana, to get them involved in organizations that are working to end the war on marijuana, and to give people sort of a less fatalistic view, because there are so many people that just think, I think pot should be legal, but it's just never going to happen. And if you can show them what it would actually look like, I think they get much more motivated to do something about it, to come out of the closet about it, and to envision a world where we aren't arresting people for what they choose to put into their own body absent harm to others. So I think that alone is probably the most significant benefit of something like Seattle Hemp Fest, especially because it's so large and that message and that image reaches so many people. So it may not be the most effective way to reach the swing voters. And in fact, the more they focus on the sort of hippie side of things and the counterculture side of things, the more they're probably going to turn off some of the swing voters, and that's the downside to it. The upside is that they're really mobilizing the people who are, people who are kind of already with you but may not have done anything about it. They're mobilizing those people whether they know it or not. And they're providing those people with a vision of the world that is much different than they may have had before they stepped onto the Hempfest grounds.
Well, you gave a far more extensive description of your views of why you thought it was positive, while you gave many fewer words to believing that Eric Sterling had a point. So am I to conclude that you, as well as a lot of other people on the blogs that responded to Eric, and to Eric's credit, and my history with Eric, and we're not going to get into that here, but to Eric's credit, at least on the blog, I read that he took some pretty serious heat for a lot of what he said, and he, again, to his credit, has backed off and reconnoitered the situation and realized that maybe he was a little too strident in his
sure. So,
thoughts.
And one of the things Eric is really good at is provoking a controversial discussion, and he did that. And I think it's good for somebody to come in and challenge people.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what he had on his in his mind, to provoke provoke
Eric,
it. I think
sure, I'm not so sure about that.
Really, you think
I'm not so sure about that?
You think he's that canny?
I think he's very smart.
I think he's not smart.
I think he might have been trying to provoke some real thought and some real discussion on this issue. And he's certainly someone who's, he will change his mind if he's convinced otherwise. And it seems like he's backed off a little bit from his initial statements. And as I said, I do think there's some validity to his original statements. And I think there was plenty of validity to what Dominic originally wrote in The Stranger. You know, you could get, I talk about all of these positive benefits of having all these people come to the festival and, you know, see what, you know, a vision of the future might look like, and you know, be able to envision a world where marijuana.
Well, that's I'm going to interrupt you again. That's a very salient point, and that's what I try to do, and I know others do, and everybody does it to various degrees of success. But I think what is really lacking in the drug policy reform arena is just what you mentioned. We are not spending nearly enough time, because we're hardly spending any at all. We are not spending nearly enough time in explaining what a regulated market would look like. If we repealed drug prohibition and replaced it with a regulated market to control the sale and distribution of these substances, that's what the reality would be if we had to do it. But nobody knows what that picture looks like. Nobody really paints that picture. We're stuck up in ideological fights and medical marijuana, whether that's the right way to move forward or not. But we are not spending enough time in telling that, painting that picture to America of what a controlled, regulated market will look like.
Yeah, I think you're right to a large degree.
You just have to say that.
No. I do think you're right. I think we do need to paint that picture because there are a lot of people out there who I think support who know that the drug war has failed and who know that the war on marijuana has failed. But because they don't have a picture of in their mind of the alternative, they're not yet ready to support changing things.
Well, I think one of the best posters for that would be a very matronly grandma, lighting up a bong or smoking a bowl or trimming a little bush. I think that would do a lot for our image and change things.
Well,
around.
Absolutely, and you know, and that and. Without even maybe realizing it, you're almost making the point that Dominic made in his original piece, in that we need to get away from the image of the marijuana smoker being a counterculture hippie.
Well, I don't agree. We need to get away from that image. What I agree with is that there's a variety of ways to move this thing forward, and I'm not so sure
if you're going to convince the people in the middle, you're going to convince the swing voters. You're not going to convince them with images of counterculture types.
But sometimes you got to pander to your base, baby. Sometimes you got to just pander to your base and accept it and understand that without them, you're not going to get anywhere anyway.
There's absolutely some truth to that. And that's where I think there is some value in these types of festivals. But just imagine for a moment, you know, Seattle Hemp Fest being what it is, only with less tie-dyes and a little bit more of a mainstream image, and you still have 250 or 300,000 people showing up and, you know, consuming marijuana. That is probably a more salient image in the minds of, you know, people who won't necessarily show up at the festival, but who might, you know, read about it or see it on TV, or see a news report or something on it. It turns it from something that might turn off the swing voters and the people in the middle to something that they can understand. You know, if it looks like every other concert or every other festival and not something that it looks like it's catering to a hippie crowd, that you might actually win more people over that way.
Well, I think...
Most of the people who show up are not counterculture types.
Right.
Most of the attendees, they're not from that culture. And they would rather see bands that represent the music that they're interested in and the decorations that aren't necessarily, you know, multicolored tie-dye everything. And it's not to bag on that stuff. I mean, there's a place for that, and there's gatherings that should exist for that. But when you've got something that is so large and so powerful, like Seattle Hemp Fest, they could actually take what they've got and make it something that's even more palatable to the general public and would do even more for the issue. So, I mean, I love the guys who organize Hemp Fest. I think Vivian McPeak is one of the brightest guys I know. I think he's one of the most dedicated activists, and they work. I mean, that Hemp Fest crew works harder than I would say just about anybody who gets paid in drug policy. I mean, these people are pros. They are excellent. They do a phenomenal job. And so it's not to criticize the job that they do. And like I said, I love the festival. I love it as it is. I think it's wonderful. But that's not to say it couldn't even be better.
You're absolutely right. But the idea of having the same number or maybe another 100,000 go next year and have it be less tie-dye, more cross-sectional, different demographics, I think that would be wonderful too, because that's just another sign of acceptance across the board. But I also think everybody likes to go to the circus. You know, we all love to go and watch the circus. We don't necessarily want to ride the elephant or put the big red nose on, but we like to go and watch the circus. And I think what we need is a little more integration between the circus performers and the audience. Right now, when you go to the circus, it's pretty much a clear line. You watch, they perform, and everybody goes home. So maybe there's a way to bring some of those people in slowly at first or whatever to invite them to the circus and celebrate the fact that a lot of the people here maybe not be countercultural, but they have certain shared desires from a tribal standpoint, because most of the people are really young. I saw some older folks when I was out there with the booth, but it was overwhelmingly young people. So they don't have the 60s and all that shit. What we all have in common, though, is an appreciation and a respect in some cases for marijuana. So I don't know if the Hemp Fest itself, the Seattle Hemp Fest, should really go through too much metamorphosis. I think the drug policy reform leaders need to press their case a little more effectively and a little more forcefully than they have in the past. And it's almost a little bit of a cop out to not denigrate, but to kind of diss the Hemp Fest as being an impediment to their success in moving the debate forward. I'm not real happy.
That's not a case that I would make. I don't think that Hemp Fest is an impediment to moving forward. In fact, I think that Hemp Fest, flaws and all as it is, I think it's a net good for the movement.
Well, I do too. But do you think there's a little scapegoating going on?
How so?
Well, by suggesting that the Hemp Fest is not really helping to move the debate forward.
Well, I do think it is, and like I said, I think overall it is helping to move the debate forward. Simply by the sheer size of it alone is helping to move the debate forward.
So you don't think any of this criticism is kind of a veiled assessment of blame, shifting guilt, where frustration among drug policy reform?
I don't really.
No,
I don't think so. No, I think it's people who genuinely care about this issue trying to have a real debate as to what's the best way to go about achieving our goals. All parties involved in this are good people. I mean, Eric Sterling is somebody who I have a lot of respect for. Dominic Holden, I have a ton of respect for. Vivian McPeak and the Hemp Fest organizers, I have a ton of respect for all of them. And I know all of these guys personally. I've spent time with them, you know, socially, and I've worked with them all professionally. And I know that they all want to see this war end. They all want the same goals. And it's really a matter of taking, you know, everybody who is on the same page as to what the goals would be and having a real spirited debate about the best way to go about that. I think that's a good thing. Thankfully, none of these debates have really played out in public other than, you know, there were some articles in The Stranger. But for the most part, most of these debates and the nuances have gone on email lists.
Oh, yeah, it's a very inside game,
and that needs to happen in any movement, right? I mean, anytime you have a big group of people who all have the same goals, they're going to have different opinions on how to go about it. And it's best that, you know, rather than going at each other or fighting each other or not working together, that they hash this stuff out and that they have a real conversation about the best way to do this. And I think that's what's going on here. These are all well-intentioned people, and I don't think, yes, some feelings were hurt. I know Dominic and Viv had a falling out over this, which is a shame because they're both, terrific people, and I love both of these guys. But for the most part, it's a group of people who really care about this issue, who want to see this war end, who want to see, cannabis consumers not being arrested and shackled and put in prisons, and there has to be a real debate amongst those people about the best way to do it and the best way to go about it. And I think that's what we're seeing here, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Well, very good. I wanted to find out what your thoughts were. Again, all I did was read about it on the blog where they posted his original comments and then the comments following up. So if anybody knew what the real deal was, I knew it would be you. So thanks for giving me a much more broad perspective and context of what the deal
is. Yeah, I mean, I think it's too often people see these arguments as a sign that the movement's dysfunctional,
Well, we are dysfunctional, like any movement.
Well, who is? But who isn't?
Right. Right. So we.
But I don't think that it's necessarily a sign that the movement is dysfunctional as much as it's a sign that there's a real debate going on amongst the movement as to the best way to achieve our goals.
And what do you think is dysfunctional about the drug reform movement? What is dysfunctional?
I do think that there's not enough cooperation amongst some of the, some of the leadership and some of the organizations. I think there's a little bit too much territorial pissing, so to speak.
Well, you're right on the money.
Yeah, people thinking, this is our territory, this is our territory.
Right.
Whereas, if they would actually combine their efforts, could probably be more effective. But like with any organization, any organizations or any movement, egos are going to get involved. Credit sharing or a search for getting credit for accomplishments is going to be involved to a degree. So there's definitely an issue where some of the organizations don't work as well together as they could, even if they even if there are just some disagreements over strategy. I think there needs to be a little bit more of a focus on where they do agree than on fighting over where they disagree. Trying to identify common ground in areas where people can work together, and I think that's something that I'm very proud of at my tenure in SSDP, and I think SSDP's history in general is that Students for Sensible Drug Policy is really the one organization that has managed to stay out of all of the other internecine infighting that's gone on amongst the drug policy reform.
As I've told you from the very beginning, SSDP is the only policy reform group that has a warm spot in my heart.
Well, you guys were smart and
did a very, very good thing. Didn't mean to interrupt you, but
no. I very much appreciate that, and that's what we're going for. And we hear that a lot at SSDP. I think we're the only organization that has an equally good working relationship with MPP, Normal, DPA, and Americans for Safe Access. And when some of those other organizations have been sort of fighting amongst themselves, SSDP has managed to not only stay out of it, but still actually work with all of them and provide grassroots support for their campaigns, despite the fact that they might be fighting about the legitimacy of the campaign. We don't care about that kind of stuff. We just want to get young people involved in efforts to change the law. And if some other organization is working on a campaign to change the law, we want to be involved in it. And so we've maintained a really good working relationship with just about everybody in drug policy, and have managed to sort of stay out of that and found ways to cooperate. And I think there are some times when I think that the older folks can learn something from the kids, and I think this is one of them.
Well, I certainly agree with you there, and maybe that should be your new gig. Maybe you should be the broker for all of these organizations out there, because
I don't think anybody could pay me enough to do that.
Dog. But, sure they could. Trust me. Sure they could, but if they would listen, it's a very strong, valid point that a lot of us older guys tend not to make as freely or agree to in public. But we should and always can learn from younger people. That is the absolute truth. And I look at our leadership in drug policy reform, and I like them all. And I'm certainly not as intimately related relationships as you have with them, but I've met them all and spoke to them all on numerous occasions. So you kind of get a good feel for what's going on out there. And I believe that there is a certain proprietary pissing around the bushes mentality going on. And I don't know if that's, I think that's just inherent as people age anyway, but we certainly should be listening more and more to the young people. And I think that would be a good job for you, Chris, is to get all these guys together, slap around some egos, put on some common sense music, and get on Obama's ass and just not get off. Because I don't know anybody out there that believes that Obama really is doing all that he can, regardless of economy, regardless of two wars, is doing all he can to help the drug policy debate. Remember, he was ideology, science, not ideology.
And that is
so you get these all guys together, and maybe Obama will invite you guys over for a beer.
Well, that'd be excellent. I'd be more than happy to sit down for a beer with Bill Kerlikowski and our drug czar and Obama and all this stuff out. That'd be just no problem. If that's the administration's preferred method of dealing with conflict. Then,
and you'd do that for free. You'd do that for fucking free, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And maybe, you know, maybe the next year we can, you know, we can all sit around with, you know, with some cannabis and we can hash it out that way. But, you know,
no pun intended.
Wants to go about it, I'm at the table, no problem.
Well, like I said, Chris, I think you're the perfect guy to bring that all together, man. I really do. And I want to thank you for spending, Christ, over an hour and an hour and a half with us here inside the Opium Den today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to get your insights. And once you get your new gig, why don't you come back and, you know, get settled in your new, deal and come back and speak with us again, because it's always a pleasure.
I'd be more than happy to come on anytime. It's always a ton of fun, and I really appreciate you having me on here. It's always a really good, candid discussion. I very much enjoy it. So thanks a lot for what you do.
Hey, no problem. So, Chris Crane, thanks for coming inside the Opium Den. Talk to you later.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, excuse the pause. Something popped up on the screen as I hung up on the phone with Chris. So that was Chris Crane, former executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, joining us inside the Opium Den today. I want to thank Chris and wish him all the best as he moves forward. And I want to thank you for coming inside the Opium Den, and hope you enjoyed it. So. Until we meet again, I guess they say, I will leave you with our Opium Den motto, and that is, when good people obey bad law never changes. Thanks a lot.